20 years after the last structure in Africville was demolished by the city of Halifax, Faith Nolan released the Africville album. This 1986 release confirms Faith Nolan's place within an expanding group of African-Canadian artists who used their chosen art forms to articulate the African-Canadian experience. There is a little frequented part of the city, overlooking the Bedford Basin, which presents an unusual problem for any community to face. In what may be described as an encampment or shack town, there live about 70 Negro families. They are descendants of early settlers, and it is probable that Africville originated with a few shacks well over a century ago. Title to some of the land will be difficult to ascertain. Some of the hutted homes are on railway land, some on city land, some on private land. There will be families with squatters' rights and others with clear title to land, which is now appreciating considerably in value. This excerpt from Gordon Stevenson's 1962 report to the city of Halifax does indeed reflect certain aspects of the physical conditions of Africville prior to relocation. However, caution is advised when attempting to understand the depth of what happened to Africville. In the introduction to Fire on Water, an anthology of Black Nova Scotian writing, Volume 1, George Eliot Clark wrote that, "In showing the world as it is, Afro-Canadian writers assault modernity as a type of apostasy. They attack any creed that ignores the spirit. Indeed, the bulldozing of Africville and its Seaview United Baptist Church represents nothing less than the attempted crushing of the human soul, yet again by the agents of Mammon, in this case, industrial capitalism and its smiling agents of social engineers." The story surrounding Africville would be incomplete without discussing the question of racism. Racism is the relationship between power and prejudice. It is only when groups or individuals who maintain prejudicial views and possess the social, political, and economic power to hamper the development of other groups or individuals in a given society that racism begins to appear. Nova Scotia, the home to the largest indigenous black population in Canada. In 1767, there were 104 blacks living in Nova Scotia, 15 of which lived in Halifax. Following the American War of Independence, the arrival of runaway African-American slaves, who who had served in the British pioneer regiments formed after Dunmore's proclamation in 1775, free African loyalists and African slaves belonging to British loyalists significantly contributed to the African population in Nova Scotia. No longer wishing to tolerate the inaction of government surveyors and European prejudices, and determined to find the promised land, some 1,196 free Africans sailed from Halifax Harbor to Sierra Leone, located on the west coast of Africa, in January of 1792. Having come to view Africans as a source of cheap labor and a dependent consumer market, many provincial merchants were opposed to this exodus. Despite the colonial policy that loyalists should not become dependent upon wage labor, many Africans who had not received land titles and or useful land found themselves working for Europeans. In some cases, the good citizens of Nova Scotia attempted to falsify debit accounts or prolong indentures to prevent eligible Africans from leaving. The loss of large geographically concentrated African populations was most acute for the remaining African communities. According to Governor Wentworth,
"This immigration proves exceedingly distressful to those that remain, many of whom are unable to provide for themselves, having been heretofore assisted and supported by their black friends and brethren."
Entire communities and church congregations had emigrated. 50 families from Preston were forced to seek employment at Halifax after the departure of their land-owning brethren. The loss of skilled, literate, and/or property-owning Africans also meant the loss of resources necessary for maintaining community schools, churches, and social support systems. The remaining African population was scattered throughout the province. Though communities such as Guysborough and Tracadie remained largely intact, they faced a difficult period on the frontier. As the 18th century drew to a close, the African population remained on the outskirts of society, an isolation not entirely of their own design. When John Wentworth became governor of Nova Scotia in 1792, he declared that he would pay careful attention to the interests and protection of the remaining Africans. As he settled into the political and social life of Halifax, Africans at Guysborough, Niggertown Hill, Tracadie, Birchtown, Halifax, and other locales were contending with realities of life in Nova scarcity. At Little Tracadie, the land allocations of 1787 were taken from the Africans and redistributed amongst 36 Acadians and Negroes in 1799. In 1796, Nova Scotia became the temporary settlement for some 500 Jamaican Maroons. Unsure of what to do with these fiercely independent Africans and native Caribbeans, the governor of Jamaica, under the pretense of a truce, imprisoned the Maroons and sent them to Halifax with the first available naval escort. By all accounts, when Governor Wentworth greeted the Maroons aboard their transport, he was impressed by their character. Though the bulk of the Maroons were settled in Preston, one group was established at Sackville and another smaller party was taken to the governor's farm in Cole Harbor. A Maroon regiment was formed. Some men were employed on the construction of the citadel and the governor's residence. However, the Jamaican Maroons did not wish to remain in Nova Scotia. Feeling as though the government of Jamaica had played a cruel trick in sending them to the cold climate of Nova Scotia, they petitioned both Wentworth and the colonial secretary in London to be removed from Nova Scotia. When ordered to work the land, they refused. When threatened with the loss of rations, they replied that they would simply take what they needed. After constant political maneuvering on both sides, the Jamaican Maroons sailed for Sierra Leone in 1800, and the events following their arrival in the colony are yet another interesting aspect to the history of Africans in the diaspora. As the Napoleonic Wars moved across the Atlantic Ocean, life for African Nova Scotians appears to have improved. Because large numbers of laborers were required to drive the war economy, Africans once again became a cheap source of labor. At the same time, a number of indentures ended, which permitted many Africans to work for wages. Africans who had been admitted into 1st Battalion Halifax Militia were considered fine young men in every respect to the white militia, both in discipline and appearance. British demands for labor were also satisfied in 1813, when escaped African slaves began to arrive from America. Then in 1814, Vice Admiral Cochrane proclaimed that, quote, African slaves that came to the support of the crown would be sent as free settlers to the British possessions in North America or the West Indies, where they will be met with all due encouragement, end quote. Before the war's end, some 2,000 slaves would take advantage of Cochrane's offer. Unfortunately, the crown and the colony were ill-prepared for a large influx of free Africans. Melville Island, the former military prison at Halifax, became the processing and treatment center for the black refugees. The refugees were settled at Preston, Hammond's Plains, Windsor, Colchester Road, Refugee Hill, and within Halifax city limits. These settlements were often made up of small infertile lots, and in many cases, the African refugees were only given licenses of occupation rather than title deeds. For much of the 19th century, African Nova Scotians devoted much of their energies to settlement within the province. Under the direction of Father Richard Preston, the African United Baptist Association, founded in 1854, became the leading organization within the African communities. As the province entered into Confederation, African Nova Scotians had established separate churches, mutual benefit and temperance societies, fraternal lodges, a militia company, and a labor association. Many of the groups and institutions found in the African communities were recognized by their European counterparts and as such were part of a larger multiracial social framework. Although the exact date of settlement is uncertain, William Brown and William Arnold were the first to purchase lands, 6 acres each, at the northern end of Campbell Road in 1848. Located on the Bedford Basin, a convenient location for fishing and obtaining employment within Halifax, Africville enabled residents to escape the hardships encountered on the rocky and barren lands of Preston and Hammond's Plains. The name Africville can be traced back to as early as the 1860s, where it appears on various railway documents and petitions to the city of Halifax from area residents. In the early days, Africville resembled an isolated rural community rather than an urban neighborhood. Elderly relocatees remember raising farm animals, horseback riding, skating on the Bedford Basin, and riding trains to the North Street Station. Organized in 1849, the Campbell Road Church quickly became central to the social structure of the community, and its membership in the AUBA forged a link to Baptists throughout the province. Although Africville residents petitioned the provincial government for educational assistance, it was not until 1864 that free or tax-based schools were established within the province. 26 years later, the Africville School was established. Under the guidance of black teachers, including world-renowned vocalist Portia White, the Africville School remained in operation until 1953. In 1853, the Rockhead Prison was built on the hill above the community. 2 years later, the Nova Scotia Railway Company laid the first railway line through Africville. Private land was expropriated, and some claimants were not compensated for many years. By 1858, the city of Halifax closed the night soil disposal units in the south end and relocated them to the edge of Africville. The infectious disease hospital was built in 1870, and in 1903, the Trachoma Hospital was built to the west of the city prison. Following the Halifax explosion on December 6, 1917, the Halifax Relief Commission, which was established on January 22, 1918, and charged with the responsibility of administering funds and supplies necessary for the reconstruction of the devastated city, all but ignored Africville. Interestingly, the commission's single reference to Africville revolved around a discussion to remove Aaron Carvery and a Mr. Beals, who were deemed to be squatters on the city's industrial land. The industrial infrastructure that had developed around Africville included a bone meal plant, a cotton factory, a rolling mill, 2 slaughterhouses, several stone crushing plants, a tar factory, a shoe plant, a foundry, and port facilities for handling coal. Finally, in the 1950s, the city dump was moved to the northern end of the peninsula. just 100 meters from the westernmost group of Africville homes. There can be no question that, as a community, Africville possesses great potential for development. However, it is apparent that by the middle of the 20th century, that the rural setting of Africville had been methodically driven into decay. Although the city of Halifax had proven itself incapable of contending with the difficult challenges presented by Africville, Africvillians have shown a clear understanding of and a willingness to do their part in rectifying the unusual problem. Interestingly, up until the middle of the 20th century, Africville's role as a transition point between the rural and urban experience for Afro-Canadians continued. Born in North Preston, George Grant followed his brother to Africville, where he eventually married Louise Carvery. Together, they built a home in Africville, raised a family, and like so many others in the community, enjoyed the love of friends and family. George Grant.
Well, it was people in general, you know. We used to, like to play the guitar, and we used to get down on in the evenings, and everybody get outside, play music and mm-hmm. singing. Oh, of course, we have a little drink too, you know.
Yeah.
But it was the friendliness. Everybody was just together, you know, just like one big happy family. And we had a place we called South Preston. We used to play horseshoes, play ball. Kids would play hockey there in the wintertime. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would have, and so, I mean, musical entertainment, stuff like that, that was all...
Oh, it was great, yeah, musical entertainment. Most everybody played music. Mm-hmm. And they had a hall there, community hall. And Africville had a hockey team that used to play all over New Glasgow and Halifax. And they also had a ball team. That they used to play, was great sportsmen there. You know, everything was together there, you know. It was one of the close communities that I've seen. I've been just about every place in Canada. Mm-hmm.
Although he moved from Africville at age 13, Irvin Carvery's memories of Africville just prior to relocation do not lend themselves to the images of slum housing so commonly portrayed by those from without. Irvin Carvery.
The games we played in Africville depended upon, you know, what season it was. During the summertime, we spent a lot of time in the water, because being right on the Bedford Basin, so we spent a lot of time swimming. But in terms of games, we would play the normal kids' games like Red Rover, tag, hide and seek, baseball, a lot of baseball, football, those types of games. And in the wintertime, you know, we changed our sports, went to hockey. We used to, the ponds used to freeze over. We used to play a lot of hockey. Tobogganing and sledding was the big winter sports that we played in the wintertime.
Was there any organized sports like that were included within the city?
Yeah, not the city, but Reggie Carver used to organize a hockey team called the Brown Bombers. And a lot of the Africville guys played on the Brown Bombers hockey team. There were some back in the old, way back in the days, there were a lot of women from Africville played on women's softball teams. And there were a lot of boxers came out of Africville, a lot of fighters, and so they were involved in that sport. And basically that was it.